Aye. The Chief Judge and Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome everyone to this court session of the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Today, the courtroom at the University of Colorado Law School has been converted into a federal courtroom, and we would appreciate it if your decorum reflects the seriousness of this proceeding. However, and it's something that we never do when we are sitting in our courtroom in Washington, at the end of the session today, we will adjourn, and at that point, we will take questions from the audience, a rare opportunity from a federal court, with the caveat, of course, that you can ask no questions about the case that had just preceded the question and answering session. The case that we have today is the United States versus Bowen. We have quite a bit of argument today because we granted two amicus requests. The order of argument will be first the counsel for the appellant, followed by the amicus in support of the appellant, counsel for the government, followed by the amicus in support of the government, and finally the appellate's rebuttal. Are counsel ready?
Yes,
Your Honor. Okay. We'll first hear from the appellant.
Good afternoon, Chief Judge Erdman, and may it please the court. I am Major John Legg, and I, along with Lieutenant Colonel Jeffrey Palomino, represent Airman Bowen, the appellant in this case. Can a head nod by a victim pulled out of unconsciousness in response to law enforcement's suggestive questioning be an excited utterance? We contend that no court has stretched this exception to the hearsay rule that far. Accordingly, the Air Force Court should be reversed for two reasons. First, the military judge abused his discretion in concluding that Mrs. MB's head nod was an excited utterance. And second, the erroneously admitted evidence prejudiced Airman Bowen in this case. Turning to the first point, in this case, the military judge abused his discretion in holding that the head nod to security forces personnel was an excited utterance by failing to account for the highly suggestive nature of the question that was asked by law enforcement personnel when they moved Mrs. MB from a bathtub and placed her on the bed, and both specifically identified the appellant and vaguely asked, "Did your husband do this?" And the evidence that this court has in the record is
that. Are you questioning whether a head nod can be an excited utterance, or are you looking at all the surrounding circumstances?
Judge Olson, I think what we're looking at is the quality of the question here, the qualitative nature of the question. And of course, there are cases from that have been cited by the parties in the briefs from the 10th and the Seventh Circuit, which say that statements in response to a question can be an excited utterance, but those courts have expressed caution in stretching the hearsay exception that far. And specifically, none of the cases cited by either party allow the suggestive interrogative question that was here. Courts have allowed questions like, "What happened? Who did this to you?" But no court has found that a question by law enforcement to somebody who literally seconds before was unconscious, where they identify a person and suggest it was them, that was an excited utterance. And I think that...
Are you suggesting that she was so pummeled that she was incapable of an excited utterance? Or are you suggesting, or you're obviously saying this isn't one. Are you suggesting she is so beat up that she's incapable of such an utterance, or what are you suggesting?
Well, Your Honor, the military judge found himself that Marissa's MB was not capable in the record. Specifically, he said she was in no position to testify about her own mental state at the time of the assault. But I'm focusing more on the lack of spontaneity here. The Federal Advisory Committee notes, as cited in our brief, say that spontaneity, when referring to an excited utterance, is the key factor that you look at. And I think that that is borne out by this court's...
Well, but you haven't really answered the question. I mean... An excited utterance is supposed to be spontaneous. That's what the explanation of the rule says. But my question is, was she so beat up that she was incapable of a spontaneous utterance? Or what's the government's, what's the appellate's position on this?
Well, I think that the facts in the record show that she was not capable of a spontaneous declaration at this point. And that is borne out by the military judge's ruling. But even more so, it was not spontaneous because it was in response to a suggestive question identifying the accused. And also, the suggestive question was vague in that it said, did he do this? Which that could be interpreted a number of ways. One way could be, is he the one that put you in the bathtub?
Well, what's the difference between asking an open-ended question, which you indicated would be permissible, and asking what is essentially a leading question here, as far as spontaneity is concerned?
I think that that's where the line has to be drawn at some point. Now, Chief Judge Erdman, I may have gone too far if I said that open-ended questions are always permissible. That's not appellant's position. I think that the courts have found that there are occasions where open-ended questions can be permissible if the response is truly spontaneous.
Well, is it your position that it wasn't spontaneous because she was pulled out of consciousness? I mean, I think that that's what we're trying to get is why precisely is it that you're saying that the statement wasn't spontaneous? Or is it more than one thing?
I think it's more than one thing, Judge Ryan. I think it's the fact that she was pulled out of unconsciousness. That's one of the things. But also, I think if you look at the rationale of the courts that have allowed questions, such as the Seventh Circuit that the government cites in the Webb case and the Gross case, or the Tenth Circuit that we cite in the Paxton case, I think that those courts express caution about allowing a holding that a statement in response to a question, and specifically a law enforcement question, is a spontaneous statement.
Well, they've always said that that's one factor, right? That's one factor.
Absolutely, but as the advisory committee notes say, it's perhaps the most important factor, the spontaneity of the interaction. And here, the record bears out that law enforcement was on a evidence gathering quest when they entered that house. They entered. They looked at who's.
Should we be looking at what they expect to hear?
Well, I think what the court should be looking at is precisely what this court said in Feltham in the three-prong test. And I think if you apply that test faithfully in light of the cases that examine interrogative questions. In Felton, this court said, the statement must be spontaneous, excited, or impulsive rather than the product of reflection and deliberation. The event prompting the utterance must be startling, and the declarant must be under the stress of excitement caused by the event.
But I mean, under a very narrow reading of the first prong, it could never be an answer to a question, because that would never be impulsive or spontaneous. I mean, under the strictest meanings of those words.
And I grant that, Your Honor. But
that's not the law.
Well, I think the law is, as I described it, that if the statement, if the question is an open-ended question, then that question can result in a spontaneous declaration. If that question essentially is not interrupting what otherwise would have been a startling and stressful event. The government argues in its brief that essentially the questioning was part of the event here, and I would argue that that is incorrect, that essentially leaves no limiting principle upon an excited utterance, because if you take the excited utterance exception to the hearsay rule that far, it could be virtually anything. Law enforcement could engage in a detailed question and answer session.
Well, back to the chief judge's question. This is a leading question, obviously. Did he do it? Did your husband do this to you? Does that in and of itself scotch its being an excited utterance?
Your Honor, I think appellant's position is that on this record, yes.
Okay.
Because she's coming out of unconsciousness.
She's unconscious by definition. They pull her up.
Right.
She's beaten to crap, beaten to death. They pull her out of the tub. She's wet. She's got bleeding. They put her on the bed, and only then do they ask the question.
Absolutely.
You know, now, from the record, it doesn't appear that being pulled out of the tub and put on the bed got her sort of conscious, or whether asking the question got her sort of conscious. I don't know. But
Your Honor, I think, Judge Stuckey, there could be circumstances where if the victim, the declarant, exhibits symptoms or is symptomatic of being in an excited state, such as in cases like Donaldson, where the minor child was crying hysterically, potentially the government has a better argument in that situation. But here, it's the combination of the fact that you have a unconscious victim who is aroused from unconsciousness by the actions of law enforcement, who are on an investigative mission. And then they ask a highly suggestive question that identifies who they believe is the perpetrator at that point.
Counsel, you keep talking about the unconscious victim. And that makes me wonder whether or not we should be looking at the mental status of the victim after she's regained consciousness. Here's a person who has three times the legal limit of alcohol in her blood veins. She has a traumatic brain injury, and she is just barely coming out of an unconscious state. Is that person capable of making a rational mental determination?
Chief Judge Erdman, I think the answer is no, and I think that is relevant both to our argument that this was not a spontaneous statement and our argument that the probative value of this statement was not outweighed by the unfair prejudice it presented because of the vague nature of the question.
What about the trustworthiness of it? I mean, the trustworthiness underlies all of the exceptions to the hearsay rule, which is why they're allowed. You assume that because of the circumstances, the statement is going to be trustworthy.
Absolutely, Chief Judge Erdman. I think the circumstantial guarantees of trustworthiness that as a policy matter, the rules look to justify each exception to the hearsay rule. In this case, those circumstantial guarantees are lacking. And I think that's why this is not an excited utterance here. If I may, I want to briefly move to the second portion of my argument regarding the prejudice analysis, because of course, if it was error, the government shifts, or the burden shifts to the government to prove that this error did not have a substantial influence on the findings here.
Before you get there, what exactly are you arguing that the military judge did wrong? Did he get the facts? Were they clearly erroneous, or did he misapply the law?
Your Honor, I think the answer is both. Of course, he could abuse his discretion either by being influenced by an erroneous view of the law or finding clearly erroneous facts. I don't know that this court has clarified whether the spontaneity portion is a mixed question of law and fact or not. But to the extent that the judge found as fact that it was spontaneous, I think that that's clearly erroneous, based on his own words that she was under no position to be able to exhibit excited symptoms. So I think the answer is both. But moving to the prejudice analysis, I think it's important to look at the findings in this case to understand how important this testimony was. It was the only evidence from the victim's mouth that identified her husband as the perpetrator. The other evidence was self-serving testimony by Airman Beebe. And if you look at the findings, the members essentially acquitted the appellant of portions of the allegations that depended primarily on Airman Beebe's testimony.
Well, yeah. Which way does this cut? You maintain he's prejudiced. She's beaten to within an inch of her life. She suffered permanent injuries. He didn't even get a punitive discharge. He got 1 year and a bus to E1. How's that prejudicial?
Well, I think that that goes to the residual doubt the members had here on the findings. If we were solely arguing sentence severity, then I think Judge Stuckey, that would be a very well taken point. I think that the analysis is reversed in this context, where if you actually believe this happened, you would expect a panel to give a relatively severe sentence. But what they did is they acquitted him of specific language in the charges that depended on the testimony of Airman Beebe, which tends to suggest that the members believed the evidence that Mrs. MB gave to them. And they took her testimony both in acquitting the appellant on the assault in Nevada, because she said that that was self-defense, and in acquitting the appellant of portions that depended, such as throwing into the furniture and the wall and the knife, slapping back and forth with the knife. This was all evidence that Airman Beebe brought to the members. But the only evidence before the members that, from the victim's mouth, that Airman Bullen was the perpetrator was this identification. There was so-called ear witness testimony by neighbors, but those neighbors, the record bears out that they were not close friends of the Bowens. They had heard them through the walls, but they were themselves awakened at 6 in the morning. And a rational panel, you know, certainly if they did not have the identification evidence from the victim's own mouth pointing to Airman Bowen, these neighbors who didn't know the couple very well, who testified that they think it was his voice in the bathroom, I think that testimony is much weaker. And the government has to show that erroneous admission of the this is the only identification by the victim, that did not substantially influence the findings. And I don't think that the government can meet its burden to do that. I would like to, I see I have 30 seconds left, I'd like to reserve the remainder for rebuttal.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. The court will now hear from the amicus in support of the appellant.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Captain Patrick Coomer, arguing amicus curiae on behalf of the appellant, Airman First Class Elwood Bowen. As you've been discussing, the question before the court today is one of the admittance of a hearsay statement. And Judge Erdman, when you pointed out that in explaining the exceptions to hearsay, the advisory committee noted that the underlying policy behind that is that certain hearsay statements have guaranteed trustworthiness to them. Before the court today is whether or not the head nod of Ms. Bowen rises to that level of trustworthiness such that it supersedes the inherent risks with admitting hearsay statements. We ask the court to reverse the lower court's decision because, one, the military judge in this case incorrectly applied the standard when conducting the Feltham test, and two, the record itself does not support an excited utterance under Military Rule of Evidence 8032.
It seems as though you're arguing that there's a difference between what the military judge did and your view that she needed to subjectively believe that she was being spontaneous when she answered the question. Could you explain that a little bit better, please?
Your Honor.
If that is indeed the difference, the distinction that you're making.
I think the difference in this case, Your Honor, is that the military judge, when she looked at it, did not apply the Feltham test through the eyes of Ms. Bowen. So what I mean by that in particular is the judge said in her reasoning that she thought it was reasonable in light of the facts that this was an excited utterance. And reasonableness standard historically is an objective standard, not one subjective through the eyes of the declarant. So I think it speaks both to the spontaneity, but in particular to the third prong of the Feltham test, in that the declarant must still be under the stress of the excitement when making the statement.
Were you saying that she couldn't be stressed because she'd been pummeled to within an inch of her life and was passed out from drinking too much?
Yes, Your Honor. I think those facts all point to that she could not have been excited at the time that she made the statement. And, Your Honor, I would go, too, to the descriptions that the security forces personnel gave of her when they did describe her. They said that her eyes were closed and she wasn't talking, that she was semi-conscious and unable to give any meaningful response. So I think what we have to do when we look at this is see whether or not a person in that state is able to give a statement that is so trustworthy that it supersedes the risks of hearsay.
Well, if she was incapable of excitement, could it nonetheless have come in under 807, which is kind of a general, you know, guarantees of
catch-all
for stuff? You know, you don't require spontaneity, but you do require guarantees of validity.
Yes, Your Honor, and I understand that 807, the catch-all, the underlying fact in that, too, is whether or not there's the guarantees of trustworthiness.
Yeah.
And I think for the same reasons that it does not apply to 8032 are the same reasons that it does not have the guarantees.
Well, no, but the spontaneity prong's gone. And you've got, in addition to her being beaten up and her responding with the nod, you got the neighbors saying they were having a fracas over there. We heard his voice. We heard her screaming. Doesn't that add something? Doesn't that add something to its trustworthiness? At least enough to get it. But remember, we're dealing with abuse of discretion here. It's a very low standard.
Understood, Your Honor. I think that all of those facts still do not talk to whether or not when they take Miss Bowen out of consciousness and have her on the bed and ask this vague question, whether or not a head nod and a groan then rises to the level of trustworthiness, whether or not it's spontaneous. It's the only question that she responded to in any sort of...
Well, it was the only question that was asked, wasn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
But
so when they're bringing that didn't show much. Yeah.
When they're bringing her out of consciousness, though, Your Honor, she's not talking to them. She's not speaking to them. And she responds just with a groan and a head nod. And I think for the same reason that shows it fails the third prong of the Feltham test is the same reason that it does not satisfy the residual hearsay exception.
Okay.
But what is it in the timing or in the circumstances here that would lead us to believe that there was that her head nod and groan was like the result of reflection or that there was a risk of fabrication? Because isn't that what the exception is concerned with?
Your Honor, that's one thing the exception's concerned with, but it's also a three-part test. And I think whether or not it's found that it was spontaneous or excited, and I understand that you're concerned with whether or not she has some sort of time to reflect and make up a response. I think also you have to look at the excitement, which is why it's the excited utterance exception. And I think by not having that element of excitement and the state of mind such that she was in at the time that she made the head nod, all point to seeing this is not a trustworthy statement to get past the hearsay exception.
Well, is the lesson here then, if you're going to beat her up, do a good job? So she's incapable of any utterance?
Your Honor, two things to that. First, I think any person in a state where they are conducting this horrible assault is not thinking about what's going to happen in the courtroom. And second, when we look at hearsay statements, Your Honor, we're worried about making sure that there's a fair and impartial trial. And I think that as horrible as domestic violence is, we still need to go back to whether or not these rules of hearsay are met and whether or not they are such that it meets the criteria of excited utterance.
Counsel, I'm interested in hearing you talk a little more about getting to the subjective viewpoint of the victim. And how do you do that when the victim is in the state that this victim was and then can't remember at the time of trial exactly what she was saying? How then, other than looking at the circumstances surrounding it, how then do you get to a perspective, how do you get to the victim's perspective in that situation?
Yes, Your Honor.
I guess what I'm asking is how can it be subjective from the standpoint of the victim if the victim herself can no longer remember?
Your Honor, I think that the facts of the case of the traumatic brain injury that Ms. Bowen suffered during the assault, the intoxication should have been taken more into account when discussing whether or not this was an excited utterance. And you use when the victim cannot remember, you use the testimony of the security forces personnel who were there and are testifying to how Ms. Bowen looked, how Ms. Bowen was acting, and how Ms. Bowen was responding, to then at least try to put yourself in the position of Ms. Bowen when she's being asked the question, your husband did this to you. A vague question, particularly for someone who is in the state of mind such that Ms. Bowen was in at the time that the security forces personnel posited that to her.
So are you taking issue simply with the military judge's language in the findings? In other words, the use of the term reasonable?
That's one thing, Your Honor. I think the lack of the military judge's consideration of her level of intoxication and the injuries in which she suffered also would factor in that. On top of that, Your Honor, the record such that it is does not support an excited utterance under 8032, particularly because it does not support that third prong of the Feltham test. In cases such as Donaldson, where the child was still crying when she made the statements to her mother, or in Feltham, where the sailor in that case was crying and clearly distraught when he made the statement to his roommate about the assault that he had just undertook, there's nothing in the record that supports that she reaches any level of excitement. And I think stretching this exception that far would swallow up this exception itself.
I have a question. If it's beyond the scope of what you're prepared to respond to, that's fine. I mean, I understand that you're an amicus. Do you have a position as to whether or not, if we were to conclude that this was testimonial hearsay, meaning that it was a statement that the officer reasonably could have expected to elicit an incriminating comment about her husband, whether it could still fall within a hearsay exception?
I see my time's up, Your Honor. May I please?
You can respond to that question.
Judge Ryan, I don't think that the testimonialness of this matters because she did testify. Since she took the stand, I think whether it's a testimonial, non-testimonial statement.
But if she doesn't remember saying it, how can there be any opportunity for meaningful cross-examination?
I'm not prepared to speak to that, Your Honor. But I think her ability to be cross-examined would kind of negate the Fifth Amendment concerns there.
Okay. Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court will now hear counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Erdman, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Major Meredith Steer, and along with Mr. Roger Bruce, I represent the United States in this case. The implicit premise underlying the excited utterance exception is that the person who reacts to a startling event or condition while under the stress of that event will speak truthfully because of the lack of opportunity to fabricate. It is the existence of a deliberative period and the opportunity to fabricate that has been stressed by this court in Donaldson and by other cases that have led to outlining the bounds of the excited utterance exception.
But all of those cases, right, are concerned with that particular facet in the context of, and because of that, we can think that this has sufficient indicia of reliability that we can believe it's truthful, that it's trustworthy, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Could you repeat that?
The reason that we care about those things is because we say, oh, and because they didn't have an opportunity to fabricate and they didn't have time to think about it, we can believe it. We can think that it's truthful.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so here's the question is, why should we trust a head nod from a person who is, as the appellant's counsel has said, you know, suffering from a traumatic brain injury and has a blood alcohol content of 3 times the legal limit?
And I think that's something that the military judge appropriately considered under the 403 balancing test here and ultimately decided that as the gatekeeper of the evidence, it was something for the members to consider and that the defense then could attack the actual trustworthiness as far as whether Ms. MB was truly responding and understood the question that was being asked of her and was affirming that it was her husband who had assaulted her versus perhaps putting her in the bathtub and giving her a bath, as appellant tried to suggest.
Counsel? The Seventh Circuit said in talking about this exception that the circumstantial guarantees of trustworthiness all presuppose the mental capacity of a reasonable person in the position of the declarant. If the mental capacity was lacking, so are the guarantees of trustworthiness. Now, where in the military judge's opinion do we get any indication of that there was the mental capacity to make a spontaneous declaration rather than just a very confused, semi-conscious person who is obviously seriously impaired?
Well, Your Honor, I think all parties spent a significant amount of time questioning Tech Sergeant BC about that. They asked her very specifically, what did you say to her when you first happened upon her in the bathtub? The officer explained that she had told Ms. MB that she was a member of security forces. Ms. MB responded with groans. Once they decided that she was safe to move to the bed, they moved her to the bed. At that point...
But that all has to do with the security police's testimony, not the victim's testimony.
That's correct.
And what we're interested in is the capacity, the mental capacity of the victim at the time this question was asked.
That's correct, Your Honor. And Ms. Tech Sergeant VC went on to talk about the fact that when they asked the question of Ms. MB, it was a very deliberate head nod up and down, and that was explored by the military judge. But I don't think that the case law has said that there has to be the declarant on the stand talking about the fact that she indeed understood very explicitly what the question was and had the mental capacity at that time to make a statement. For example, when you have child victims who are of the age of 3 and 4 years old, you allow a doctor to come in and testify about the fact that the child understood that they were in a doctor's office and that they were there to get medical treatment.
So you don't think the victim's mental capacity in this situation has any bearing upon our determination?
Your Honor, I think it goes to the weight of the evidence and not its admissibility, and that's what the military judge, given the range of choices that he has under an abuse of discretion standard, he appropriately weighed those concerns under his 403 balancing test. He noted that Tech Sergeant VC was very clearly testified that Ms. MB nodded her head affirmatively to the question. It was a very deliberate head nod, and at that point, the military judge, as the gatekeeper of the evidence and using the abuse of discretion standard, allowed the members to hear the evidence and allowed the members to give it the appropriate weight, considering the fact that the members did hear that Ms. MB suffered a subdural hematoma, had a craniotomy as a result, had a traumatic brain injury. The members heard all of that, and you can, I think, be confident that the members gave it the appropriate weight.
Well, two questions for you, which is, one, where in the 403 balancing test is there any discussion by the military judge of whether he considered her mental capacity, her alcohol intoxication, her brain injury in determining whether this was probative evidence when he did his balancing test? And a follow-on question is, if he didn't consider that, what do we do?
Well, Your Honor, those were some of the arguments that were made by the trial defense counsel immediately before the military judge made his ruling. They brought up the fact that she was intoxicated at the time, and then the military judge put his MRE 403 balancing test. And this court does not require a military judge to go through every single argument that was made by trial defense counsel, but you require the military judge to apply the law under MRE 403.
Also require them to, like, look at the facts, like, reasonably, correct?
Yes, Your
Honor. And we've held that a failure to talk about an important fact is deemed to have not considered it.
Well, Your Honor, I think you still give the military judge discretion in his ruling in that case. You just may not give him the substantial discretion.
Let me ask you one other question related to what I asked the amicus.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which is, I'm going to, because I agree that given the fact that she testified, right, that it's almost certainly not testimonial in that context. But let's change the facts. She doesn't testify. And this government witness comes in and testifies to her making this statement. It's clear, from my perspective at least, that they asked the question seeking an incriminating response from her about her husband doing this, right? So would you agree that that's a testimonial statement?
Well, Your Honor, I not only agree with you, I think the military judge found that. He found that the statement would be testimonial, but he said that...
Okay, so then here's my question. If something would be a testimonial statement, right, if she didn't testify, how does it qualify as an exception to the hearsay rule when the whole purpose of making this new rule about testimonial versus non-testimonial was to undercut the sufficient indicia of reliability nonsense?
Well, Your Honor, this was not an issue that we briefed before this court, but I think that
I'm allowed to have questions anyway, right?
Yes, Your Honor. But to the extent that I'm able to answer it, this was something that the Air Force Court addressed and the military judge addressed, and I believe it was Owens and Rhodes that the military judge applied. And given the fact that he looked at the relevant case law on this issue, I don't think you can say that he abused his discretion when he found that the statements, although testimonial, because Ms. MB was able to take the stand, then the defense was afforded a meaningful opportunity for cross-examination, and therefore the statement should come in.
I just remember we wrote an opinion probably a couple years after I got on the court, and it was talking about whether something fell within the business exception to the hearsay rule, right? And part of the analysis in that case was if it's really a business record, right, then it's never going to be a testimonial statement. Would that cut the other way? If it's a testimonial statement, it's never going to be a business record.
I suppose so, Your Honor.
If this would be a testimonial statement, I mean, you would expect that if it was truly an excited utterance, that it couldn't be a testimonial statement, but you would think that it would work in the opposite direction, too.
Well, Your Honor, I think that is a fair consideration, and if you would like some additional...
No, I mean, I recognize that you didn't brief it. I just was thinking and wondered. Sorry.
That's fine, Your Honor. Thank you.
Counsel, what level of excitement is necessary for the exception to come in?
Your Honor, I think when you're talking about excitement and spontaneity, the typical thing that everybody thinks about is the example that we get in law school about an excited utterance being prompted by an extremely stressful event, and then you have somebody waving their arms physically in the air, heavy breathing, things of that nature. But when you look at the dictionary definition of spontaneity, really what that definition says is that it just has to be not the product of reflection and deliberation. And that is what...
And because she was beaten almost to death and presumably had no opportunity for reflection because, as Judge Ryan pointed out, number one, she was blind drunk, and number two, she'd been beaten half to death. She probably was not in a reflective frame of mind.
So it's
the government's position that given those facts, it can still be spontaneous or that excitement just kind of falls off. What's exactly the government's position?
Well, Your Honor, I think that you have to look at all of the facts and circumstances here, and that spontaneity does not require shouting and screaming by the declarant.
Okay, yeah. Otherwise, it would be the shouting and screaming exception. but what about this situation? I mean, presumably she had little opportunity for reflection.
Absolutely.
And so you're saying that the thing it turns on is the lack of opportunity for reflection and concocting a story.
Yes, Your Honor. I think when you look at all of the case law on excited utterances, that is what the court is focused on, especially when you look at the Donaldson factors, which I think are the controlling precedent here, and that it's not just one factor that's dispositive. The court in Donaldson expressed that there are a number of factors that a military judge should look at.
Counsel, if spontaneity is not the product of reflection and deliberation, and if it is spontaneous, that is enough to qualify under the exception, what if the individual is not capable of reflection and deliberation? I guess under your argument, the same result would hold.
Well, yes, Your Honor, because I think what the excited utterance exception, when you look at the drafter's analysis and the case law, is focused on is whether the statement itself is trustworthy as far as it's not been a product of the ability to reflect and think of a different explanation. So it's not necessarily...
But in regard to that, can a question from law enforcement be so suggestive and so accusatory that it essentially vitiates the sense that the victim has not had a chance to reflect? If a response is being fed to the victim, why shouldn't that give us pause about the opportunity to reflect on the part of the victim?
Well, Your Honor, I think the fact that there is a question, whether leading or not, is just but one factor for a trial judge to consider.
But do you understand our concern, which is we're dealing here with someone that essentially was beaten to a pulp with blood all over their face that was essentially unconscious, that was later diagnosed with a subdural hematoma and a brain injury to the point that they required additional surgery and then had an extremely high blood alcohol content, right? And so you want us to say that that single head nod had such sufficient indicia of reliability that we can also disregard the fact that it was a response to a very leading question. Do you see what I'm saying? I mean, it's an all the circumstances sort of thing.
Yes, Your Honor.
You seem to be discounting the circumstances that we're concerned with, and I think that Judge Erdman has been asking about, like, what do we do if we're not convinced that she could, like, that she had the capacity to answer a question, like, honestly, truthfully, with any thought whatsoever?
Well, Your Honor, I think you have to go back to the abuse of discretion standard and the fact that all of these facts were laid out for the military judge, and the military judge, using the case law and applying it to the facts in the circumstance, found that he, as the gatekeeper of this information, it met the standard for an excited utterance. But ultimately, the weight to be given to that statement and whether it should be trusted ultimately should be going to the jury. And that is what the military judge did in this case.
Is it the government's position, basically, that the admittedly very low standard of abuse of discretion saves this thing?
No, Your Honor. Certainly, I don't think that the abuse of discretion standard is a safety valve for the government here, or that the military judge can hide behind an abuse of discretion standard. But when he applies the law, and he did, he applied those three factors from Feltham on the excited utterance, he found, and to answer one of your questions about the excitement that Ms. MB was undergoing, I don't think you can discount the fact that the military judge did find that Ms. MB expressed.
No, he made findings on the record. I am disturbed by the fact that she was blind drunk didn't really enter into his analysis, but go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, the military judge found that there were manifestations of excitement just before the security forces happened upon the scene. Her neighbors identified the fact that Ms. MB was screaming in pain. They identified appellant's voice.
Well, I don't think any of us are discounting the fact that an exciting event occurred, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Right, that's the exciting event, right? There's a brawl. Right? That's the exciting
yes, Your
event.
Honor.
That's the first thing you need.
Yes, Your Honor.
But there's another two questions, which is this an excited utterance, and was it related to the exciting event?
I agree, Your Honor.
Let's say we give you, yes, if this was an excited utterance, it was related to the event because it's saying who did it. We're focusing on the second question.
Yes, Your Honor. And I understand.
Is the yelling and screaming before, that doesn't help you with that question.
Well, I think it does go into the analysis of whether Ms. MB was still under the stress and the excitement of the event. And the
fact
was
passed out.
Yes, Your Honor. However, but the fact that just before security forces arrived, her neighbors heard her screaming in pain, the military judge found that that related to her state of mind at the time that security forces happened upon her. But I think you have to look at the totality of the circumstances, and I just want to point out two cases to this court. First of all, one cited by the amicus for defense, that was United States versus Brito. There, the case in the First Circuit there was analyzing an anonymous 911 call where the declarant didn't take the stand or was never even identified. Nobody testified about the way that she appeared at the time, the stress of her voice at the time. What the court noted was this person said that somebody had a gun pointed at her and her son, and based off of what was going on in her 911 call, the court there said that that eroded any basis for the declarant to be in a calm and reasoning state when she placed that 911 call. So they admitted the 911 call there as an excited utterance without ever hearing from the declarant and what her state of mind was at the time. Additionally, if you look at United States versus Frost, which is cited by appellant, that case there was looking at the fact that there was suggestive questioning from the police officers there, and the police officers had to lead the declarant through her story. In Frost, the 10th Circuit discussed United States versus Clemenons, which was a case from the 8th Circuit. And in that case, the officer testified that the declarant was talking in a very calm manner, very reasonable manner, but was laying on the ground suffering from multiple gunshot wounds. And there the court said that qualifies as an excited utterance because it would be unreasonable to conclude that someone recently suffering multiple gunshot wounds is likely to calculate who he might unfairly blame for his injuries. So amicus for defense, I think, brought up the fact that the military judge used the word reasonable within his ruling. I don't think that any case has ever held that a declarant has to testify as to her state of mind, and the military judge must specifically hear from the declarant on her state of mind, especially when you consider 8032 does not turn on whether a declarant is available or unavailable, putting aside, of course, your concerns about testimonial nature.
Counsel, how much deference should we be giving to the military judge with the 403 aspect of this case? He said the nodding of the head was highly probative, but it was really rather conclusory, wasn't it?
Well, Your Honor, I disagree with that. The military judge noted that compared to the sounds that she had been making before and the groaning that she had been making and the testimony of Tech Sergeant BC, he can use all of the circumstances to conclude that it was more probative than it.
And what does that have to do with probative? I mean, she was moaning, and then she was asked this question and apparently nodded her head. How is that probative?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, the military judge, I think, implicit in his ruling is that she's moaning moments before, but when she's asked a specific question about what happened in this case, then she nodded her head in the affirmative, and the military judge said that was probative as to whether it was appellant or someone else that had caused the injuries.
But is probative is the only issue when we're determining whether something is probative or when the military judges is whether it's good information to against the defendant, or is it whether it's likely to be true or whether it's reliable, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
I think whether it's relevant to a question in the case, and that could be any number of things, but here, whether it was relevant to whether appellant was the one who caused her injuries. And
Counsel, did you want to address prejudice at all?
Yes, Your Honor, I would like to. Ms. EG and Staff Sergeant AS testified that they heard unequivocally appellant yelling at Ms. MB or someone else in the premises, "Why are you naked? Who are you effing? You're pregnant." They identified that voice as appellant's, and no other voices were heard. The event was still ongoing when Staff Sergeant AS called security forces, and he didn't see anybody else leaving the premises. Then, Your Honors, you have Ms. MB's injuries, and the United States invites this court to take a look at the photographs of both Ms. MB and Senior Airman BB. And you have those injuries, and those photographs are compelling. Finally, you have the testimony of Senior Airman BB, and I laid out in my brief how Ms. MB, the most defense-friendly witness in this case, actually corroborated his testimony. But Tech Sergeant BC also corroborated his testimony. She talked about the fact that when she arrived on the premises, she saw water and blood on the floor in the entryway. And Senior Airman BB talked about the fact that Ms. MB, after she was dragged out of bed by her hair, thrown into a wall, and then thrown into the entryway, then appellant went and got a glass of water and tried to throw it in her face.
Wasn't he acquitted of all that?
No, Your Honor, he was not.
He was not acquitted of dragging her by her hair and throwing her in the entryway and throwing her in the furniture?
They accepted out some of those words, but they did find him guilty of that specification that he had struck
her. But they accept, you know, it's by exceptions and substitutions, right?
Yes, Your Honor, but you can look to all the facts and circumstances there.
Counsel, I see your time has expired. You may briefly conclude.
Thank you. The military judge did not abuse his discretion when he personally observed the witnesses and the arguments of counsel and exercised his discretion within a range of choices that was based on the facts and the law and admitted the head nod. Regardless, there is no question that the admission of the head nod did not substantially influence the verdict, as there was overwhelming evidence of appellant's guilt in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court will now hear amicus in support of the government.
Chief Judge Erdman, members of the court, may it please the court. Your Honors, my name is Adam Zanger, and I appear in amicus curiae in support of the appellee United States government in this matter. This case is an opportunity for this court to clarify the level of deference owed to a military judge.
Counsel, could you speak up a little?
Yes. This case is an opportunity for this court to clarify the level of deference owed to a military judge when making a decision to admit evidence under Rule 803.2, and to uphold its own precedent that harmless error should not result in reversal.
So you think this is a how much deference we should give to the military judge will determine the outcome?
It may not be determinative, but it will certainly support the appellee's position and this decision, the decision by this court to affirm the lower court's decision. This court has already recognized and stated that the standard of review in this case is abuse of discretion. But this court has also acknowledged in prior cases that that is a term of art which encompasses a wide spectrum of deference, and especially with regards to specific decisions made by military judges. In this particular case, the decision made by the military judge to admit this statement, particularly his factual analysis surrounding whether or not the declarant was in the proper state of mind to give an excited utterance, is similar to the decision by a military judge to admit a statement by a declarant for the purposes of a medical exception.
The determination as to whether or not she was in the proper state of mind, does that bring up the issue of whether or not she had the mental capacity to be responding knowledgeably to any question?
That may be a factual determination that the military judge would take into account.
Did he make that determination?
With regards to what the military judge actually said about her mental state, as has already been stated, she was not necessarily in a position where she could make outward manifestations of excitement. But in looking at the circumstantial evidence surrounding the declaration, the military judge weighed the facts and determined that she did have the required state of mind to make an excited utterance.
Counsel, how much does the military judge have to put on the record, in your view, to get the deference that we are supposed to give him or her? When they make their ruling, how much are they supposed to put on the record?
I believe it needs to be obvious that the military judge weighed the appropriate factors with regards to what someone in that position would be thinking, or the types of the perspective that person would have.
Well, maybe not on that specific issue, but in general, when the military judge is making his or her ruling, how much do they have to put on? How much of the facts do they have to actually put on the record? Or are we to simply assume that the military judge knows the law and he heard the witnesses, saw their demeanor, took into consideration all the facts, and made the ruling?
Well, if we take, for example, in a similarly or a related issue, the 403 balancing test requirements, for example, require that a military judge set forth in the record that he considered the factors involving both prejudice as well as the probative value of the testimony. It doesn't set forth specifically how much needs to be on the record, but that he made the case on the record. And in general, where a 403 balancing test has been applied, this court has found that that type of reasoned decision will be given a higher standard of deference than not. So with regards to your specific question, it's not clear how much should be on the record, but there should be enough that this court should be comfortable with allowing the military judge deference in that ruling.
So can you point me specifically, do you have this statement in front of you, the military judge's ruling on the record in front of you?
I do.
I mean, I understand that he talks about the fact that, about her head now, but what findings of fact does he make as to why this is a spontaneous statement? I mean, there's lots in there about why this was an exciting event, but where does he make the findings as to the three prongs as to why the other thing as to why this is an excited utterance?
Certainly.
I mean, he says that it qualifies as an excited utterance, right? And he talks about screaming in the excited event, and he talks about the fact that she was in no physical condition to manifest outward expressions of excitement, but where does he say, nonetheless, it was an excited utterance because 1, 2, 3?
He doesn't say that specifically. He says the fact that screams were heard, shouting and banging heard in the bathroom only a few moments before, combined with her physical condition, it's reasonable.
Okay,
that's the specific language.
Okay, and where, and I'm sorry, I should have done this to the government counsel, not to you, but it's with trial by fire. But where, anywhere in this analysis, either the exception to the hearsay rule or the 403 balancing test, can we be confident that the military judge considered her brain injury or her alcohol incapacity and her ability to basically come up with any realistic or truly responsive answer at all?
I think just from the language I just stated, the fact that he considered, he says, combined with her physical condition, he alludes to the fact that he did in fact take into account her physical condition, both her intoxication as well as the subsequent trauma that she had suffered. So he certainly makes clear that he did consider that.
Well,
and it's primarily...
Well, he's considering as to why she couldn't manifest outward expressions of excitement, right? But he's not telling us how he considered as to why this was probative or reliable or trustworthy, et cetera, et cetera.
And I think maybe where the confusion is coming is that the way that I responded to Judge Sparks' question, by comparing what is required on the record for a determination of 8032 and the Rule 403 balancing test. And I was making an analogy there. In this particular case, what we're setting forth is that where a military judge makes a preliminary determination of fact, in this particular case, where he looks at the facts and he determines whether or not Ms. MB has the required state of mind to make an excited utterance. That decision should receive a higher level of deference. And this court's recognized that. It's recognized that with other hearsay statements, for example, the medical diagnosis exception. I pointed the court to United States v. Hollis in my brief, and it's very analogous to the determination in this case, where in that case the judge found that a child's statements to a medical officer, the child had the requisite mental state.
Can we agree with you that the military judge should get a lot of deference about whether or not a declarant had the required state of mind to make an excited utterance, and still disagree with you that that's reflected in this particular ruling?
You may, Your Honor. Certainly.
Thank you.
However, in this particular case, because it is analogous to Hollis, because it required a judge to, I mean, in that case, you have a child declarant, and they're very incapacitated in their own way to testify as to what their own mental state at the time of giving a declaration is. In this particular case, we have very similar circumstances where the declarant couldn't remember her state of mind at the time. However, in weighing the facts before him, the judge made this preliminary factual determination. And this court has held under other rules, for example, 8034, that kind of a determination receives great deference.
Okay. Law school exam question. Are we sneaking back into Ohio v. Roberts here? We're talking about indicia of reliability, you know, and in the Confrontation Clause cases, the Supreme Court threw that out. So where are we here from a jurisprudential standpoint? Do we still have to consider that when we're dealing with hearsay? Because we have no choice? Or I'm asking, you know.
It should still be a consideration of this court, certainly. However, with regards to applying a very similar level of deference to this particular decision that this court has applied in other cases, this court stands with its own precedent and that of the Supreme Court for quite a while. I don't see it as a step backwards, rather, or neither is it as an extension. It's just simply a recognition that questions of this kind, factual determinations of this kind, receive higher deference by this court, even higher than, as you so knowledgeably pointed out, the abuse of discretion standard already being a low bar, already being significantly deferential. If a court is to find that a preliminary factual determination is made on the record, slightly greater deference might actually be appropriate.
Thank you.
Your Honor, I see that I'm out of time. May I please conclude?
Briefly conclude?
Thank you, Your Honors. With regards to the standard of review in this case, Your Honors, it's our position that because this is a mixed question of law and fact and it required a preliminary factual determination by the military judge, it should receive even greater deference. And we echo the position of the appellee that the admission of this evidence was not substantially prejudicial in this case, and therefore the lower court should be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. The court will now hear the appellant's rebuttal.
Your Honor, I have 3 points that I'd like to make on rebuttal. First, with regard to the victim's mental state. At JA 41, the military judge asked Sergeant Cabrera, "What makes you think she understood the question that was asked?" She answers, "I don't. I just know that it was asked and she shook her head." The evidence does not support that the record here, that this person was actually making the sort of statement that we contemplate when reviewing, when looking at the subjective qualities that Amiki discussed on behalf of the appellant. My second point, with regard to the 403 test, the military judge does invoke 403, the language of 403 as a talismanic incantation on the record, but he simply says that it's high. And I would say that if the probative value is so high, that's compelling with regard to prejudice, because if it's so high and so compelling, then that means that this contributed to the conviction here. So I would ask your honors to note the military judge's finding when you make an analysis of prejudice. Then with regard to my colleague's statement that the evidence was overwhelming, the Air Force Court did not dare go that far. The Air Force Court basically said that Airman Beebe was generally credible, and said that there was more supporting, and this is on factual sufficiency, that there was more supporting the government than the defense in the court's perspective. But if the Air Force Court does not find that the evidence was overwhelming, I would respectfully state that my colleague's claim to that effect is not reflected in the record. In admitting the head nod here, the military judge abused his discretion and did so to the substantial prejudice of Airman Bowen's right to a fair trial. We respectfully request that you reverse.
Thank you, counsel. The court thanks counsel for all of the parties. The case is now submitted, and the court will stand in recess until further order of the court.